The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is poet George Vilgaire. He's the Witter Binner Fellow at the Library of Congress. He was chosen by Billy Collins, our United States Poet Laureate. And here's George with an opening poem.
Corned beef and cabbage. I can see her in the kitchen, cooking up for the 100th time a little something from her limited Midwestern repertoire. Cigarette going in the ashtray, the red wine pulsing in its glass. A warning light, meaning everything was simmering just below the steel lid of her smile as she boiled the beef into submission, chopped her way through the vegetable kingdom with the broken-handled knife I use tonight, feeling her anger rising from the dark chambers of the head of cabbage I sliced through, missing her, wanting to chew things over with my mother again.
The voice of George Vilgaire. He's the poet who has two books, Big Bang and The Going, which was a Devon's award-winning book, and a new book just coming out. It's from the University of Akron Press, and it won the Akron Prize. It's called The Good Kiss. And how could a book miss entitled The Good Kiss?
Yeah, I hope that maybe it was the title that helped give it the nod, but my stuff has tended in the past to be so gloomy that I thought maybe a title like this would make the book seem a little more attractive.
How very interesting that you should say that. Gloomy, I never would have attributed that to your book. I'll tell you what your poetry is today. You'll find out. You don't know.
Yeah, that's why I'm here. I want to find out what I'm doing.
This is what George has done. He's written these two books. He's won this prize. He teaches at John Carroll University in Cleveland. His poems have appeared in many of the best literary journals, including Poetry, The Swanee Review, Plowshares, and his poetry has been featured in Best American Poetry, both in 1992 and 1999. He's received grants from the NEA and the Ohio Arts Council and was a Fulbright Fellow in Spain. And some of the folks out there don't know how very competitive these competitions are, how thousands of poets hope for and enter these competitions. Mm-hmm. And if you win one, I don't know that people understand, like an NEA fellowship is the poet's lottery.
Yes.
Every poet in America goes for it.
That's right. It's really tough. And, I mean, any poet listening to this broadcast knows exactly what you go through. It's kind of a leap for life, and you send in the manuscript, you do the best you can with it, and then about the time when the results are to be announced, you somewhere in the back of your mind you're thinking, well, maybe it could happen this year. But more likely you get a very polite letter saying, we would like to congratulate so-and-so, not you, on winning this prize.
And there were so many entries.
And there were, 16,000 entries. And no, realistically, there usually, I think, for these things, there's something like, they can be 800, 1,000 entries. And
well, you
tough.
Know, The New Yorker gets 5,000 poems a week.
Mm-hmm.
So just figure.
Yeah,
just go figure.
A lot of poems being written today. It's just amazing.
Well, I love your work. And I feel that poetry is coming back to something that it needed to come back to when I found you. So let the audience judge for itself, and let's hear some more. George Vilgaire, this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and George is a Witter Binner Fellow in Poetry.
This is a poem from the new book, The Good Kiss. It's called Like Riding a Bicycle, and I think, there's one of the rites of initiation, one of the rites of passage for every kid is learning to ride a bike. And I think some mysterious American tradition dictates that it be the father who teaches the kid how to ride a bike. This is a poem about that American ritual. Like riding a bicycle. I would like to write a poem about how my father taught me to ride a bicycle one soft twilight. A poem in which he was tired and I was scared, unable to disbelieve in gravity and believe in him, as the fireflies were coming out, and only enough light remained for one more run, his big hand at the small of my back, pulling away like the gantry at a missile launch. And this time, I wobbled into flight, caught a balance I would never lose, and pulled away from him as he eased, laughing to a stop. a poem in which I said that even today, as I make some perilous adult launch, like pulling away from my wife into the fragile new balance of our life apart, I can still feel that steadying hand, still hear that strong voice telling me to embrace the sweet fall forward into the future's blue equilibrium. But, of course, he was drunk that night, still wearing his white shirt and tie from the office, the air around us sick with scotch, and the challenge was keeping his own balance as he coaxed his bulk into a trot beside me in the hot night, sweat soaking his armpits, the eternal flame of his cigarette flaring as he gasped and I fell, again and again, entangled in my gleaming Schwinn, until he swore and stomped off into the house to continue working with my mother on their own divorce, their balance long gone, and the hard ground rising up to smite them, while I stayed outside in the dark, still falling, until at last I wobbled into the frail, upright delight of feeling sorry for myself, riding alone down the neighborhood's black street like the lonely Western hero I still catch myself in the act of performing. And yet, having said all this, I must also say that this summer evening is very beautiful, and I am older than my father ever was as I coast the Pacific shoreline on my old bike, the gears clicking like years, the wind touching me for the first time, it seems, in a very long time, with soft urgency all over.
The voice of George Bilguer. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. That's what I'm talking about, that poem. It is, someone asked me what your poetry was like. An engineer outside the studio. And I said, well, I'll never forget his mother and father, and they are just characters in his poems. I will never forget them, because he is able to break your heart without sentimentality in the way Stanley Kunitz can do that. Mm-hmm. You know, the elegant way of bringing a specter of a time and a place to you, an essence of these people that made your life. And I feel that this is what American poetry needs right now in history. I think Kunitz started that, where it was, he made it an intellectual force, where feeling was an intellectual force. We've gone all over the place again, and now it has the elegance and dignity that it did at one time. And that is why you're being compared to Frost.
Well, yeah, it's wonderful you would say that. And I certainly didn't consciously go about approaching the story of my parents' life and their marriage as a kind of, I don't know, remedy to an intellectual coldness in American poetry. But I'm drawn to difficult abstract poetry, but I tend not to write it. I'm really not any good at it. I like to read John Ashbery, and I certainly enjoy the experience. I am capable of enjoying the experience of reading an entire 3-page poem of which I essentially do not understand a single word, but I could never write that. So,
you're a narrative poet, and very much in the American grain, I think. The elegance is there, the precision, and more than one person has compared you to Frost, which I think is very, very interesting.
Keeps coming up for some reason. So I feel that I should get a little cabin in New England and start, you know,
I think you should just do exactly what you're doing and keep doing it and keep reading it to us right now, another poem.
Well, I'll read a poem that's somewhat in the same vein as the one I just read, again from the new book. The poem is called The Table. I'm helping my brother-in-law knock apart an old table by the tool shed, a table they've loaded with planting pots and fertilizer bags for years, until a decade outside in wind and rain has done it in. And suddenly, as in a myth or fairy tale, when the son recognizes his lost father under the rags of an old beggar, I realize it's the kitchen table of my childhood, where my mother and my two sisters and I regathered and regrouped inside a new house in a new state after the divorce, where at the end of every day we talked about our day, practicing our first fictions over pork chops and mashed potatoes when Mom had a job, or fish sticks and fried Spam, or chicken pot pies when she didn't, where we dyed our Easter eggs and played through rainy days of Scrabble, where I sweated over algebra and the infernal verbs of the Germans, and our mother would drink a bottle of wine and lay her head down and weep over everything, terrifying us into fits of good behavior, of cleaning and vacuuming until she snapped out of it as if nothing had happened and made it up to us by doing something crazy like making pancakes for supper. The table where my uncle got me drunk for the first time and where I sat down for dinner for the last time with my grandmother. The table where my sister announced she was pregnant. Where I said that on the whole, Canada seemed to have a lot more to offer than Vietnam.
Hmm.
Plain brown table of 1,000 meals, where the four of us came to warm ourselves at the fire of family talk. But I'm starting to sweat now, the hammer overmatched by iron-grained walnut bolted at the joists. It takes a wrench and a crowbar to finally break it down to a splintered skeleton, to the wreckage of an old table, built when things were meant to last, like a hardcover book, or a cathedral, or a family. We stack up what's left for firewood and call it a day.
George Bilger. The problem of relationships, Grace Paley says they're impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you do is struggle with that, mm-hmm. and find out what's possible in them. And you always have a beautiful evening in your poetry. That's why it's not gloomy. There's always a beautiful evening in one of the lines of some sort, because you haven't given up on relationships.
No, and I'm glad you put it that way, because it, you know, it really helps me see it in a different sense. I don't want the work to seem pessimistic. I always want there to be some kind of vindication, that some sense that out of the most difficult crises comes something good, something you can work with, something you can build on. And no, I don't think any of my poems ever despair, but they usually find their occasion in something that's not particularly great.
But the one thing your poems do, they're inevitably going to be popular. I mean, very popular. You're already well known among poets, but because your life is our life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to make that sound better than it is, but every one of us has had something that you're telling about. Well, that is a pretty important thing to give a reader, I think.
Yeah.
And in addition, some people of consequence have observed what your work is, and I think Anthony Hecht is a very discerning poet.
Well, and one I'm very fond of.
He doesn't give many blurbs.
No, I've got one of the rare Hecht blurbs.
And he says, what is of the Big Bang, I'm holding in my hand, a former book, what is most wonderful about this enormously impressive collection of poems is the sustained excellence of poem after poem with never a false note. The reader's expectations are quickly raised high and never disappointed. And that is really true. There isn't a lump under the mattress. Do you work very, very, very hard to go over line after line?
Yeah, I do. I write the poems out. I always want to finish a poem in a single sitting, but I put it aside. I mean, you know, Horace says put a poem aside for 9 years. I don't have that much time. I put it aside for a couple of weeks, and then I read it aloud, And reading aloud, to me, is the essential thing. That's where the music of the poem really lies. And where you go wrong, you can usually hear it when you read it aloud. And I will do that over and over and over again until the poem sounds, until it sounds right and it reads well.
Read aloud. Read aloud to us.
Well, I'll read something from The Big Bang that is a slight departure from what we've been hearing. Years ago, I lived in Denver, Colorado, and I've lived in a number of cities in the U.S. Usually I end up in the Midwest or the West, it seems. And one thing I've done almost everywhere I've lived is volunteer to do poetry workshops at convalescent homes, nursing homes. You always have such amazing experiences. The people you meet there are so eager to do it. And since I teach in a university, and I teach people who are 19 and 20 and really can have a wonderful sense of language but don't often have a lot to talk about yet at 19, it's great to have people writing who are 90, you know, 100 in one case. This is a poem by about one of those experiences. And the poem is called The Bull. Lulled by her tape of Chopin's Etudes, I am driving Jane, who rarely gets out, down through the farmlands and valleys on the way to Santa Fe, country she's only read of. Jane is 70 or thereabouts, never married, with the memory of some childhood horror still hovering about her. For a long time she cared for a sick sister, and that was a kind of life until the sister died. Now she says little, except about the wildflowers, an ocean of them streaked with reds and blues and yellows, mixed like paint with our speed, their names a whisper of Latin on her lips. Also, she is a hunchback, a barely noticeable growth, lifting its precipitous biology from her shoulder, where it lives its perfectly secret existence under the same tent as her breasts, which, because of their odd companion, no man, it seems likely, has ever visited. We are speaking of the flowers when I round a curve and hit the brakes. A bull has usurped our road for footing as he tries to mount a cow. Pinned awkwardly between his forelegs, she is switching from side to side, whether out of coyness or terror, I can't tell, but his fat pizzle is waving like a scimitar in the sun, slapping her flanks as she moos under his struggle to keep atop her, his 1,000 pounds shuddering and heaving, while Jane and I watch without a word, Chopin pouring from the tape deck, and nowhere to turn, no wildflowers to name beyond the colossal bodies that at last have merged, the cow's eyes blackening into implacable pools as the bull drives himself into her with sickening force, and on the other side of the windshield, Jane pulls her pink cardigan about her shoulders and says, "Well, I guess we're in for a show."
I thought there is a Roland Flint has a poem about the zoo, taking his children to the zoo and observing the children want to say, "Go on, Daddy," and Roland is saying, "No, let's wait just another minute." I thought you were going to read us the poem that other, is it called Convalescence?
Oh, yeah, there's another
poem
from
when you were working. I didn't know if you were working in a
It's another convalescent hospital story. Well, you want to hear it?
I love it.
I'll read it. It's called Convalescence. My job that summer was to feed them at the end of their lives, years after eating meant anything. One guy swore he knew Lincoln, and sometimes even became Lincoln, as now and then were revolving doorways in the hallways of the home. His specialty was telling salty tales about slave girls, mostly, until one night the great emancipator came for him. The oldest human there was over 100 and wore a pink nightie that was forever falling open as I fed her.
Mm-hmm.
"My pretties," she called them, pretending to blush. Then I blush and spill the whipped ham onto the crumpled paper ball of her face. At midnight, the girl and I would park by the city lake. There were stars and sunken constellations, local mysteries on the radio. But beyond kissing, the whole purpose of those sessions was to open her blouse, which happened when her hands did nothing one night to stop me. And there, in the blue glimmer of the dash, were her breasts, rising in their power, suddenly changing everything, as if a window had opened. I put my head against that heat and listened carefully for centuries.
Mm. That's the book, The Going, and mm-hmm. of that book it was said, the poems of George Bulgare detail the beautiful, heartbreaking conversation between light and the darkness of human surfaces. There we go again, not since Robert Frost has any American poet so accurately transcribed our fleshly, verbal lives.
There's a lot of flesh in my poems.
But without lust. I must say, if mm-hmm. someone says to me, I wrote down, longing without lust. That's mm-hmm. where Frost gets in. You see, anyone can sweat it out on the page, but to keep the innocence and that discovery, yeah. that breakthrough in every poem, that is a different thing.
Yeah, and isn't that where the poem often is? It's in the longing, it's in the distance, you know, between one person and another, and trying to bridge that.
Poems are, yes.
It seems that once you've come together and all is well, why write the poem about it?
but you always have a poem within a poem, it seems to me, and that's what keeps us going. I think The Good Kiss is one of my most favorite things I have read in a very long time, and I am given a lot of poetry to read. I just got so close to that. I got so next to it.
That whole story, essentially the manuscript.
The
book is a story of a divorce more than anything else. Mine, it's not only about that, but it comes out of that. And, writing through a crisis, I think you're never more alive than when you're suffering. And I needed to write that book and just to hold on in a way.
I didn't think of it as the story of a divorce. That's interesting.
I don't think it's that explicit.
No,
But poem after, every four or five poems, I come back to it again. I wrote it right after I got divorced, and it was really, it was a way of putting the whole debacle.
Well,
the whole
worth
nightmare.
The divorce, I might say.
Yeah. I have to get divorced every summer.
A blessed experience.
But,
we're at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, talking to George Bilgeier. He has been published in many, many wonderful magazines in this country, the Shenandoah, Chicago Review, New England Review, Prairie Schooner. And as I said, he has two books out, a third coming, has been in the Best American Poetry. How does that happen?
I don't really know. It must be very complicated. There's a fellow named David Lehman who runs the series, and every year there's a guest editor. And this poor guy or this poor woman must, I don't know, go through every literary journal written that year. I'm not quite sure. But,
or people,
maybe people send
like
in choices.
Like a push cart, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Maybe someone sends him ideas, or maybe this person just, one of the labors of Hercules just piles through all of these.
So you really don't know.
You don't know.
It's an honest thing. You don't have a friend on the board.
No, you get a nice letter. And it's happened a couple of times, and someone says, Robert Bly took one time. Robert Bly wrote me a letter and said, I'd like to take a poem, and I said, yes. And last time it was Charles Simic, the guest editors. So I guess
they're two very different.
Read a lot.
That's interesting. They're very different poets who are so far from your poetry.
Isn't that funny?
Yes. It shows I have greater faith now. When I hear that, because usually we tend to like things which are like ourselves.
Usually happens, and so I was really pleased with that. And you want to hear the poem that Simic?
Yes,
took?
I would be interested in that.
It's in Big Bang, and it's another poem about my father. It's called Catch, and I guess I realize as I'm about to read it that. Just as the poem about riding a bicycle was really a poem about an American ritual, so is this poem, Catch. My father came home with a new glove, all tight stitches and unscuffed gold, its deep pocket exhaling baseball, signed by Maze or Mantle or the Man or some lesser god I've since forgotten. He took off his tie and dark jacket, and we went outside to break it in, throwing the ball back and forth in the dusk, the big man sweating already, grunting as he tried to fire it at his son, who saw now, for the first time, that his father, who loved to talk baseball at dinner and let him stay up late to watch the fights unfold like grainy nightmares on Gillette's cavalcade of sports, the massive father who could lift him high in the air with one hand, threw like a girl. Far and away the worst we could say of anyone. His off-kilter wind-up and release, like a raw confession, so naked and helpless in the failing light that 30 years later, still feeling the ball's soft kiss in my glove, I'm afraid to throw it back.
I can see why that won.
Yeah.
I can see why that won.
Yeah, I guess he liked it, so. The great thing about being in Best American Poetry is that lots of people actually read that. I mean, people pick that up at the bookstores, buy it, give it as gifts. And being a poet is, for the most part, a rather quiet and lonely business. But when that comes out, you get all these letters from people, and you get a faint sense of, you know, how nice it would be to have lots of people reading your stuff.
Because if they can buy just one book, why not buy the best American poems of that year?
Yeah. So it's always great to hear from people. Someone on the other side of the country will write and say, just wanted you to know that that poem meant something to me.
And that means something to you.
It means
people
a
don't,
great deal. They have no idea.
They don't realize. Why hold it in, folks?
Mm-hmm.
Don't hold in those compliments. If you feel something, you take the poets beyond caring. They do.
Oh,
they think,
absolutely.
Oh, he could care less what I feel. It keeps you going.
Right. And most of the people who hear your stuff, you know, a wife, a girlfriend, a best friend, a sister, someone is going to tell you how great it is. So when you get therefore you can't really believe it. So when you get a fan letter, even a note, a postcard, that's tremendous.
George O'Gare, I'm Grace Cavalieri. I have a question you may not know the answer to. Why do you capitalize every line in The Good Kiss?
Oh,
and sometimes you do not. Sometimes you do in other poems, and sometimes you don't. And I look at it and I say, I don't think this is completely a formal poem, and I don't know why he decided to do it here.
You want me to tell you the real answer?
I do.
I'm a little embarrassed to tell you this.
Your typewriter was stuck.
No, it's a great question. I was one of those people who stuck with the typewriter for years and years and years. I would only use a type. I'd write things out in longhand. And I loved the sound of my old Smith Corona clacking away. And I just kept doing that until two summers ago. I spent the summer in Santa Cruz, California, staying with my sister, working on this manuscript. My sister and her husband have a wonderful house on the beach. It's a great place to work. And they had no typewriter. They are very high-tech California, Silicon Valley kinds of people. And I had to learn to use word processing. However, and this is the sad truth, WordPerfect capitalizes automatically.
That's right.
And I don't know how to turn it off.
That's
so
right.
So that's the answer.
I always go back and delete it all
turn
and do
it,
them. And
yeah.
You know, everything capitalizes automatically. It's not just WordPerfect.
So I don't. I
so
do
you've
not
made
have,
literary history, and
that's right.
Scholars in future years will say, you know,
scratching their heads. I know.
I know that this is a special.
Yeah, I wish I had some wonderful, complex aesthetic behind that.
That's
but really.
Crazy, but normally, wouldn't you say that it formalizes the line?
I think so, too. Yeah, it's a strange thing. But somehow I thought, well, if WordPerfect wants to do it, I kind of liked the way it looked.
It could be a message.
Sure.
And it won a contest.
It works, so I'm going to do it that way from now on.
Mm.